There's an interesting new book called Culture Wars that's been put out by a professor for a sociologist from University of Virginia, James Davison Hunter. And there he argues that what we have in our country now is not so much diversity as war. And it raises the question whether a free society can live with culture war, and whether we really have something as harmonious and innocent sounding as diversity. What do we think about this?
One of the things that strikes me about it, and I've often, I'm by no means a constitutional scholar nor a scholar of the Federalists, but it's always struck me that Federalist 10 has to either be irony, that is, or a recipe for just what we have. And I've brought that up with people who know better than I do and say, oh no, you know, you've got that wrong. But it seems to me that this Madison's program, which he borrowed from Locke, to have the the passions counteract one another, and which he sees I think almost in an ironic way again, as a recipe for peace, because everyone's passions will counterbalance each other. Well, that's happening.
This makes for diversity.
This makes for diversity
instead of war.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call it quite irony. I think it's naivete. The idea somehow there was a horizon of common meanings and a background assumed. The passions were not going to be so separate and not going to be so diverse because there was a common idea about what reason was and the provinces within which reason would operate. And I think as the common horizon has broken down, diversity has, the recipe is there. But I think that the idea that common meanings would somehow maintain themselves was never seen as being capable of falling apart. Yet all the institutions that held those horizons together are gone, or at least in trouble.
What was the common meaning? Was it something like establishing a commercial republic, that America should be a commercial society in which people are mainly occupied with making, not just making money, but making a living, an honest living, instead of with other more passionate occupations, above all, religious salvation.
Sure. The idea was that that if we could replace the table of classical virtues, and the religious virtues, which people kill each other over,
yeah,
and have a table of commercial virtues where people recognize that it's in their interest to be peaceful and to exchange things, then in Kant's phrase, we could have a nation of demons and it could work. The problem is that's not the way people live. Although we are concerned with making money in America, obviously the debates that we see going around us now are much more are deeper than that, and they are the kind of debates that make people not want to kill each other, perhaps, but certainly challenge each other in a way that doesn't make for rational discourse.
You're sort of saying that Federalist 10, or the original intention of the people who wrote the Federalist and who also wrote the Constitution, hasn't worked.
Well,
it seems to be in the process of substantially breaking down. Again, I think because it seems to me, in fact, this is the one place where Rousseau has an influence. Extirpate all mediating groups, he says, and the social contract. But if you can't get rid of them, encourage as many as possible so they'll check one another. But of course, that was within his context of a general will. The Federalists, I think, assumed something like a general will, and the substitution for it would be commerce, rationally directed commerce, commercial activities. But the institutions behind them, while I don't think they took religion particularly seriously, other than instrumentally, the idea was that I think that those instrumental sorts of institutions would be there to inculcate the sorts of habits necessary to bring people into the market. Thus Locke is, of course, willing to allow the family as the one despotic institution in an otherwise free social setting.
Yeah, he tried to transform it somewhat to make it less despotic.
Very true.
Help out women and reduce the power of dad.
Right.
And, But in general, it looks as if this original liberal project of finding a way around religious conflict is increasingly coming into trouble. Oh, the religious question, I think, was really the fundamental question that liberalism was occupied at its origins in the 17th and 18th centuries. Today that's become the cultural question, as you see from the title of Hunter's book, that today we would consider religion as a part of culture. In the 17th century, it was the other way around, culture a part of religion.
Well, one of the points that he makes, I think, is an interesting one, is that although he calls it culture wars, he does put it right from the beginning in terms of religion. And the liberal program, as you say, the most difficult and thorny issue was the theological political problem, in Spinoza's word, or the problem of toleration. And it seems that you mentioned earlier what was the principle broad enough to keep everything together, and that's whatever that is, it doesn't seem to have worked. One of those principles, certainly vis-a-vis religion, was that religion would be tamed, that we would all be able to agree that no matter what our religious differences are, we can all agree on this, that the height of true and rational religion is toleration, is that we all agree that to downplay the particular doctrines that divide us as sects, but emphasize toleration.
Yeah, the speculative, doctrinal differences,
right. Yeah.
get put aside, and everything gets interpreted into as a new kind of Christian charity.
Exactly.
Which means tolerate your neighbor.
Which in many ways is a different religion. And in some ways, I think Locke invented a new religion in doing that. And what we see in the culture wars today is those who take their religion of toleration so seriously that they don't want to tolerate anyone else who doesn't subscribe to the sacraments of the religion of toleration.
Well, there are always limits to liberal religion, I guess, to the toleration of liberals from the very beginning. It was clear that things had to be tolerable in order to be tolerated.
Yeah.
And so it was, liberalism was never quite as diverse as it pretended. But the pretense, I think, was necessary to the sort of heart and soul of liberalism, the notion that there's a distinction between the state, which enforces things, the collective aspects of our life, and society, in which we are all private individuals and live a life of free choosers.
Of course, the state and the separation between state and civil society, as I understand it, is one of the hallmarks of liberal political life. And it's interesting to me to watch legal currents as they've developed, because that separation in the name of toleration is actually being breached all the time. In fact, it seems largely to have collapsed.
Mm-hmm. What sort of thing do you have in mind?
Well, there has been a movement to reduce the First Amendment freedom of association bar, which used to be the big separation between public and private. The classic examples, Roberts v. United States JCs. The JCs Club admitted a woman, and in Minneapolis, the National JCs said, well, you know, this is a men's only group. She sued under a Minnesota statute that forbade groups from excluding people based on sex or creed. And the court said, well, there are private groups and there are private groups. This group looks, in fact, they go through a description talking about how they proselytize, they look for members, they call everybody in they can find. Well, what this starts to sound a lot like is a description of evangelical religion, who calls everybody in they can find, excludes no one.
Yeah.
The next case, the court drops a little footnote saying, of course, religion's different, but we're not quite sure why.
Why it's different.
I think there's a trend now for the state to subsume the private. And, of course, the bigger question is one of the most, I think, problematic aspects of Locke. The notion of self-constitution in an Aristotelian sense is completely missing. and the relation between what one does privately and how that affects the polis or the Constitution doesn't seem to be there in any particularly strong way. Perhaps not there much at all.
It has a lot to do with what I've called, in something I wrote recently, that not original by any means, but a phrase that should be that I like and probably has some currency here, America's emancipated will.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't have in America, and this is really the seeds for the culture wars, I think, we don't have a sense, no matter how well-intended it was in the beginnings of the founding of the United States, we don't have, it seems to me, a real sense of a common purpose or a common will. We have a lot of emancipated wills. And really, this is what, one of the reasons that I, you asked a question earlier, it seems, are you saying that it's failed? Well, certainly it's showing signs of great strain, and I think that it goes right down to the problem of assuming, on the one hand, that we can have a politics without recourse to any notion of transcendence, at least transcendence as usually understood. I know some people try to say that the sense of toleration or the sense of a universal homogeneous state itself is a sort of a transcendent idea. I don't think that's a very interesting idea of transcendence. On the one hand, we're finding a political community that without real reference to transcendence. Now, you might argue with that. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, saying that this is a society that can't stay together without some sort of transcendently informed morality. Mm-hmm. Well, the question that's always been in my mind for as long as I've been thinking about these things is, are those two things so contradictory that one, the former, undermines the latter? And
By transcendence, do we mean God, or do we mean,
honor,
or?
Well, I mean God.
Yeah, you're
a theologian.
You're talking about caritas, literally, then.
Well, yeah. In a sense, but caritas, as Thomas Aquinas said, is the form of the virtue. Sure.
Right. Mm-hmm.
In other words, over against this idea of an emancipated will, right. A will whose end is given. That's a theological argument that is difficult to place in a political context, but I think it can inform what might be going wrong in American society.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. One of the things that I find very interesting in all of this is the question of the idea of the human person. Hobbes, in the first five chapters, of course, of the Leviathan, cuts off transcendence entirely and gives us a theory of human cognition and what humans can know. So it's all based on cognitional theory and an ontology. I think one of the pressing problems we're coming into now more and more is the question of knowing and what knowing is, how humans know, what is it they know when they know it. That really raises the question for us of whether we are free beings who are sovereign beings, or whether we're conditioned beings and conditional beings who are situated not by right but by obligation. That's the fundamental, it seems to me, the skeletal argument running through Locke, Hobbes, and the other founders of modern liberalism.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of people today think one can substitute for the transcendent something that they would call, in a loose sense, idealism.
Mm-hmm.
And one could say that what's happened in the history of liberalism is that the passion of religion, if that's a passion, the zeal for religion, mm-hmm. has been set aside, but it's, in large part, or not never completely, but it's been replaced by another zeal or passion for equality.
Yeah.
Or for maybe an emancipated equality.
Yeah. We passed from Locke to Rousseau.
We certainly have.
Yeah, right. And so that it isn't so much that we've cooled things down, but that we substituted something new to get warm about. And maybe that's what Hunter's talking about in this.
Yeah, which brings up
does this passion for equality provide a sufficient substitute for transcendence, or is it a kind of transcendence?
Well, one of the problems with it is that, first of all, as Hunter very perceptively points out, is part of the whole game is definitions. It's like playing football. Whoever has the definition controls the game, and I'll take my definition and go home if you don't like it. And so defining what equality is, of course, in America, sometimes it's easy to define. People think of equality of opportunity, and those are typically people sort of on the right, and other people think of equality of result, and those are sort of people normally classified as on the left. And again, if you think about, I guess, Locke and Rousseau, respectively, on the right and left, at least in some sense. So defining what equality is, and over that, there are great battles. I mean, yeah. Well, we have elections over them, and as we just did, yeah. But it also points out another real problem that I think is disturbing, especially to people that consider themselves conservatives, and that is that they're always being accused of trying to inculcate their morality, whereas people who would consider themselves liberals are that liberal. Well, we don't have a particular moral agenda. We just want to be, at least in public, we just want to be left alone. Whereas it seems to me that that liberalism itself has a particular moral agenda. It's not just a set of procedures whereby individuals or this thing called society that separates from the state will get along, but there is a morality at work in this procedural republic that the founders sort of didn't want to acknowledge.
Well, actually, as a lawyer, of course, procedure is everything,
yeah.
And it's partly because in liberalism we prescind from the question of the good. Proper procedure will lead to
publicly.
Good.
Publicly.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the question of and in a public forum like a court, the procedures are correct. Yeah. The good will come out of it somehow magically. Now, all of this depends, of course, on the fact-value distinction being made early on and being carried out.
Well, the good is let me defend liberalism a little.
That's right, you're a friend of liberalism, not,
right,
not liberal.
A supposed friend,
right.
A so-called claimed friend. The good for liberalism would be to live together in a free society. To do this, that requires a distinction between state and society, but perhaps that distinction doesn't go all the way down to the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And that what you could say is that we have something, a country, let's say, which comprises both state and society, which maintains this distinction, but also has a certain unity arising from the attempt, or the experiment, as the founder said, of trying to make a free society live and succeed. According to them, the previous record had been very bad, and we were going to show that this could work. So that's something that we have to show together, I say. And this might be a point against Hunter, that we can somehow live through these cultural divisions, deep as they are, and still remain one people that decides things through elections. And this is not just a procedure, say,
no.
An election. It's a way of living, and when you vote, you kind of renew your sense of being a citizen together with other people, and that's just as present as the sense of being divided from the people who vote opposite from you.
Well, certainly I wouldn't want to be seen as an enemy of a liberal democracy. I am concerned about whether this liberal democracy can maintain itself, and I think one of the things that's happened, you were talking about the liberated will. Tocqueville, of course, warns, do you not see that everything else is fled and self-interest will be the only peg on which you can hang a democracy? That raises your question about whether that's going to be enough, and I don't think that it is. But in terms of one of our largest problems with democracy now, I think the emotive self, which invites the self to define reality for oneself apart from everyone else, really cuts at the very foundation of liberal democracy, because it is supposed to be, in part, a serious discussion about how to live and why we ought to do things in a particular way. So you're right, it's more than procedural. But I think the base has shifted away from what's needed to maintain
discussion. Our society is more successful than our fundamental beliefs.
Thank God. Yeah.
would give us to think.
That's very true. Yeah,
that we now, is that because we no longer believe in the true liberalism, and we've perverted liberalism, or is it because liberalism was somehow wrong, deficient from the beginning?
I was on the train the other day, and standing there reading a book or something, and I overheard a student telling some poor unsuspecting train rider I'd entered in the middle of a conversation, and this enlightened progressive student said, "Well, I'm a constructivist," and this poor passenger had no idea what she was talking about. I said, "Well, what's a constructionist?" And she said, "Well, that means I construct my own reality. There isn't any reality." And she said this with a straight face. It was hard for me to keep a straight face as I stood there for this reason, something that I went back to earlier. The whole idea of the liberal mindset does try to teach us that indeed we are free to construct our own reality, when in fact that just isn't the way people's realities are constructed.
The original liberalism, I don't think that was.
But that's what's happened. Well, what has happened? And
the original liberalism was meant to be a reality check. You religionists,
right? Yeah.
Who believe zealously in your different gods, you people need to be confronted with the fact that you all disagree and that what you say cannot be proved.
Yeah, and you can't all be right.
And you can't all be right. And yeah, so this original liberalism had a strong dose of epistemology to make people.
Yes, it did.
Cognitivism to make people think about how they can know things, so as to keep them from being quite so sure about what they were asserting to be true about God. But now, however, I think you're right that liberalism has become perverted itself into a constructivism that doesn't believe or find any longer any reality to serve as a solid ground.
Well, the Casey decision is a nice example of it. Transition of liberty and what we thought liberty was to
the Pennsylvania abortion case,
which the court defines liberty as the right to define the self as one pleases. Well, that is a far step from Locke, a far step from Hobbes, and a notion of reality. Of course, the essay concerning human understanding has a big problem built into it, which makes the mind a black box.
Right. Well, there were problems in this original epistemology, which are now maybe coming home to roost. Yeah, but
that was the question that I wanted to pose to you, Professor Mansfield. You said something very interesting that might be a rather damning admission, that liberalism seems to have corrupted itself. Well, if that's the case, were not the seeds of corruption there from the beginning, and are we just seeing in the late 1990s, coming up on the year 2000, are we not just seeing the pre-liberal moral capital which made up society eroding and dissolving? And as that happens, then left with raw liberalism, is that not what's happening?
I would say the seeds of corruption were there from the beginning, but maybe that's a little too harsh a judgment, because I think the original liberals were aware of this, and they were aware that they were taking a risk in depriving us of the support of nature and of God. Essentially, that's what they were doing. And it's this awareness that is now been lost. So we're now too confident that we can do without these things, each of us can go on and to live his life on his own, and to make really preposterous statements that you don't really live by, but which have a dangerous cumulative corroding effect.
Yeah,
I think Tocqueville just about the transition between Volume 1 and Volume 2 warns against what he calls pantheism, but I really take to be romanticism. and what this would do to a democracy and how that sort of individualism would undermine it. I think, as usual, he was very prescient in seeing a danger, which I think is now present in the emotive self, that allows this sort of definition of reality. I think that is a far step from the original liberalism.
Yeah. The original liberalism was a right to preserve yourself, from which comes the right to liberty and the pursuit of happiness. So that's very different from the right to define yourself.
Yeah.
Because you could define yourself as a tyrant who cared nothing for anybody else's rights.
Yeah.
And people are doing that.
One of the interesting, Hobbes is very explicit on this, on what exactly these natural rights are. Locke tries to tame this new strange doctrine, as he calls it, it seems, in the Second Treatise. But in both cases, you're talking about, you just mentioned a right to life, a right to have to a life. Hobbes doesn't universalize that right. It's very individual. It's a universal occurrence of particular, of my right.
Right.
And if you're a threat to my right, then that's so much the worse for you if I'm stronger than you. Locke says a little more subtly, when other lives are not a threat to yours, then you work to preserve them. So we, you know, it seems to me that although I don't think you could walk out here in the middle of Harvard Square and get anyone to be able to tell you that that they believe in a particular, my particular right to life and to hell with everyone else, there does seem to be a sense in which that really is the despite all of our talk about community and things like that, there is something of that going on. That's why I think it's so difficult to talk about abortion in terms of liberalism, because which is something that I care a lot about, because once we put it in terms of rights language, a right to life, I think that's a disaster. I think it's already given up the game for those who are opposed to abortion.
I think you're probably right about that, and certainly abortion is a good illustration of the point you made before about liberalism having a definite and specific character, not being sort of pure diversity. But, the people who are in favor of abortion, the pro-choice people, really have a certain picture of society in their minds in which abortion is more than tolerated, in which it is respectable.
Yeah. Right.
And on the other side is really the opposite. Clinton is trying to put this together when he said abortion should be safe, legal, and rare.
And rare, right. Yeah. Well, that, you know, that's taking the pseudo high road that others, you know, you also hear, you know, the really aggressive pro-choice people saying things like that. We're working for a country where abortions are less needed. Now, you know, and obviously we don't want abortions either, so we want them to happen less frequently. So
still, it's important and interesting that they concede the point.
That is true. I find an ironic kind of way that although I'm very much opposed to abortions in almost any circumstance, that and again, this betrays my suspicion of liberalism from the beginning, is that the pro-choice people have the more consistent liberal argument. So if we're arguing about the Constitution, it seems to me that they've got the better argument. Now, that doesn't mean that the state isn't allowed to have restrictions on abortion, but I sort of think Scalia gets it right. On, there's just nothing here at all.
Well, one way to begin to revive liberalism, and I don't know whether this is a transcendent way or not, you can tell me, is to try to revive the original notion of responsibility, which is, I think, the liberal virtue, because it's not the same thing as duty, which does imply something transcendent that you have a duty to, and it's not the same thing as virtue, which implies a soul that you want to perfect. But it speaks to the voluntariness of liberalism. As a responsibility is something you take on, a burden you take on yourself. And that, for example, in the abortion question, I think it's the irresponsibility that that strikes me the most, or is the most illiberal thing about the sort of volume of abortions that we're having now, that the idea that in such an important thing as this, one can decide on the basis of convenience.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what makes you comfortable for the moment, I think. So I think one way to work within liberalism would be to try to revive responsibility.
I think that's a wonderful point. Of course, in the ancients, rights were derived from obligations. We, it seems to me, derive duties from rights, at least in classical liberalism. Mm-hmm. The duties that were derivable from your rights, Hobbes said duties, the Locke's, seem to have fallen off entirely. If you look at the legal system over the past 40 years, it's largely described, I think, as perhaps slightly caricatured, a flight from responsibility in part by universalizing responsibility. Mm-hmm. If everyone's responsible, no one really is, the tort system being a good mirror on that.
Yes, one way to ruin responsibility is to universalize it and maximize it to an impossible degree.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. Then everybody becomes perfectly responsible. Nobody really is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You might not remember, we actually had a brief conversation about this once before, about responsibility. And my concern then is my concern now, remains, about talking about that way. I think it is hopeful. But on the other hand, if, as we were talking about earlier, if Americans are full of emancipated wills, wherein, and your colleague's term, we're all unencumbered selves, Michael Sandel's wonderful term, if we're all unencumbered selves, then the very notion of doing something out of a motivation of responsibility actually makes the choice less authentic.
Yes.
Charles Taylor has been talking about this recently in his new book, The Ethics of Authenticity. So while you're correct, there's a real wind out there that even so little as a sort of a sense of responsibility actually inhibits the freedom of the choice, and therefore the authenticity of the choice, and therefore the person is less authentic.
I think you see that in the phrase pro-choice.
Precisely.
What that means is a choice which never forecloses choice. A choice which keeps your options open, as we say.
Yeah, rather than choice being choice preceding good or right, choice is good or right.
Yes.
Well, exemplified perhaps in the, there's a local public radio station, A World of Choice. This being the absolute good, just...
Yeah.
Now, this is, of course, a conservative principle, too, choice.
Sure.
Choice in schools,
choice in buying products.
Buying products and so on.
Moving around.
The base of authenticity, I think, is significantly different, or it can be significantly different from another rhetoric using the same terminology.
Choice is not so bad if it's money.
That's right. Get back to the commercial republic. Just leave it at that. Then.
Yeah, because you surely spend your money when you choose to spend it.
Right.
And you can't get it back.
Yeah.
Whereas the idea of pro-choice is to keep your choice while having your choice.
Right up to the
end. Really,
the
fundamental idea of that is you want to always stay young.
That's right. That's right, because getting old inhibits choice.
Yeah.
Dying really throws it.
Yeah, well, that's the especially in liberalism's own terms.
You know, another point that Sandel makes along these lines, and I think it's a brilliant point, on recent Supreme Court adjudication on religion, something that you know better than I do, that his point is that the court has assumed this emancipated self, and therefore, and doesn't understand selves who feel that they are not so emancipated, selves that, and he's specifically talking about religious, especially conservative, evangelical, fundamentalist type religious people, who don't feel that their religion is a mere willful, stripped down choice, but that they're compelled. And Sandel argues that in the language of recent Supreme Court decisions on religion, the court has an incapacity to understand anything, any decision that isn't pure, unmitigated choice, and it doesn't serve well for those who feel compelled to pray in school, let's say, or
well, it makes them absolutely unintelligible to the decision maker. which takes back to this, are we sovereign selves, or are we situated selves, situated by obligation that may be a transcendent obligation? The one has a good deal of trouble understanding the other.
Yeah.
Yeah, choice is an incompetent and exaggerated principle, as if you could choose everything.
Yeah,
and everybody knows that you don't. You don't choose your species. You don't choose to be born, or you don't choose your country.
It's like this woman on the train, this constructivist, you know, who doesn't even understand that she hasn't really chosen to call herself a constructionist. You know, she happens to live in Boston, Massachusetts. I mean, in Peoria, Illinois, I don't think anyone calls themselves a constructionist.
Well, you never know these days.
Well, that's true.
Didn't we used to consider that? Actually a pathology, a lack of reality,
it's called schizophrenia. Yeah,
that's right.
Right, I mean an inability to make. Aside from obligation, though, I think the importance of the inability, literally for the court and at least a strain of liberalism to understand the so-called encumbered self, apart from the sense that they have obligations, is this very point that you just made, is that even if there's not a lot of obligation coming from it, that they are products of some kind of tradition, of some kind of moral, religious narrative, is a word that's used a lot. Narrative, traditional.
It certainly is.
Community. Yeah.
A problematic term.
Yes.
Yeah, it is.
Almost as problematic as experience.
Yeah. Well, who is it? The narrative construction of reality, I guess that's Peter Berger.
Yeah, it goes with the constructivism. Sure.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Everything's a story, a narration.
Yeah, yeah.
Nothing is true.
Of course, this takes you back to, is there some normativity to the human mind? Is there some normativity possibly to our historicity? Is there any authenticity to be found?
And this is what liberalism seems to have gotten away from.
Yes.
It began from a basis in human nature. Each of us has a fixed nature, and it's on that basis that we can construct our rights or derive our rights. It's on the basis of what we don't choose that we can choose. And you have to remember what you don't choose in your thinking and not throw it over and begin to suppose that your human nature is up for grabs too.
Would getting back to your point about responsibility, do you think that a mere discussion of just personal responsibility is what, if everyone is just a responsible person to themselves and maybe minimally to their family, is that enough to have a society to maybe save Western civilization, or at least tone down the culture wars?
Well, one thinks immediately of Tocqueville again, that personal responsibility is hard to sustain if you haven't got friends and neighbors with you, and so what we need is a kind of a social responsibility that includes the making of associations and groups, movements, both political and non-political. That is central to the life of a free society. Tocqueville called it the mother art of, as well as the mother science of free people living together.
Of course, that is one of the things that has continually broken down our habit of association. Seems largely to have left us. The sorts of groups that do seem to be doing well are the clip the coupon groups, groups that require you to actually associate with other people or having far greater problems.
Well, still, on the culture wars are between such groups, aren't they? Mostly volunteer groups of people who are upset about something and associate together in order to do something about it and thereby overcome their sense of individual powerlessness and their sort of unencumbered emancipated selves to do something together.
That's right, and certainly they have a sense of responsibility.
Yeah.
Responsibility to their voluntary society or their church or their particular group.
So again, maybe what they're doing is better than what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
The groups that are involved in the culture wars.
But it still makes everything so contentious. Getting back to the question that you posed at the very beginning, is it possible to find some principle? It doesn't seem to be Madison's, because I think we'd have what Madison called for, don't we? I mean, we do have probably a much wider variety of sects and viewpoints and religions and you name it than Madison ever could have dreamed of in the 18th century.
Well, wasn't that then really the role of commerce as the softener of those passions? That you could argue about the other things, but when it came to money, now we're going to get serious, as you pointed out earlier.
Yeah, but when we're getting serious, we can also trade off.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The problem with religious salvation is you can't trade it off. It isn't negotiable.
Of course, to the extent that any sort of association is a matter of taste, it largely becomes trivial. Because religious association is a passion, a matter of taste. Yeah. The same as marrying someone is a matter of preference. Love is not wholly rational. It seems to me that the one thing that the Federalists had in mind was the few things about which everyone could agree would be the need for central government and reliance on the market, and that would more or less trivialize all the other differences. It hasn't quite worked out that way.
Well, still, wasn't there a certain patriotism, having gone through a revolution together, having established this country, a sense of doing something new? Impressive, that had never been done before in the history of man.
Which points up a crisis, right? One part of the crisis right now, especially getting back again to responsibility, there are lots of groups in America, whether for legitimate reasons or not, who feel so alienated from the political culture, from America, that they have no interest in a responsibility that looks to the good of the nation as a whole, but only their own responsibility. And they see that not as a recipe for harmony, but they consciously see it. You know, fundamentalists feel alienated. Certainly, large segments of the black population feel so alienated that they have no interest in responsibility with a view toward the whole.
Are they so alienated that they want to engage in a, so to speak, cultural or ethnic cleansing of their fellow citizens? That they, if they would have America be only themselves and not the others?
I don't think so. On the other hand,
how bad is it? I mean, and as soon as you assume, as soon as you admit that you do want the others, the people who don't believe quite the way you do in your country, then you do need something like toleration and some notion of diversity.
Yeah. But, you know, as you've said already, performatively, we've always been much better, perhaps, than the arguments among the elites. People do volunteer to serve the government in all sorts of ways. They do volunteer to serve their countrymen in various sorts of ways. We were able to get rid of the draft in part because people were willing to join the services. I think that there is a core of patriotism left.
Right. It can be foreign incentive.
Well, I'm not sure that it's always. I have a number of ex-Marine and Naval officers, and they were university backgrounds before they went in. And many of them had a feeling of obligation that they had to do something, and more than simply, "I've got to pay off my loans. Here's a quick way to do it."
Well, let's not be too severe and demand purity of motive.
Yeah.
Already, if you say that, already you've made a step towards a principle of a free society or of toleration.
Well, that sounds like something like a single moral principle that could hold the whole together. The problem is, and that's again going back to your original question. That was one of the things that we put on the table at the beginning. The problem is that instead of having one, however lowest common denominator it might be, one moral vision toward which we can all agree, despite our vast differences politically, religiously, we have at least two major ones, and perhaps a lot more.
Yeah.
And both claiming toleration, one claiming it, one wanting to be tolerated in one sense, one claiming to be the tolerant one, and neither getting along very well.
Yeah. How would one describe these two sides of the culture war? Is it really the intolerant versus the tolerant, or is it that each side would tolerate different things.
Well, I wouldn't classify it as the tolerant and the intolerant. Yeah. I think, again, if using Hunter as a touchstone, he doesn't either. I forget exactly what the terms he uses, but they're very descriptive ones, and they have to do with, I hesitate to even say because I just don't remember, but one has to do with sort of a teleology, the group sort of think that human beings have a purpose, have an end, and so should the country, and it should be a common vision, and that's who he claims he puts on the right. Mm-hmm. The other is that if we have a vision, if we have an end, it's that there is no vision or end, and everybody does their own thing. And as far as toleration goes, the sort of cult of toleration gets impatient when those who are not who don't belong to the cult complain about its hegemony. I mean, even in his private letters, some of his private letters, Jefferson said that he looked for the day when people who didn't buy this liberal toleration weren't tolerated. And Locke said it also in the letter on toleration. He said that those churches which don't inculcate these principles ought not be tolerated by society. So again, I guess I'm not even a friend of liberalism. Maybe I'm just a near acquaintance or something. Of liberalism. but there is a sense in which if it's so dependent on it on peace is liberalism so dependent on toleration for peace is liberalism that it isn't just it seems to be coming down in America these days, not just to a commitment to tolerating other points of view, but a more fundamental moral commitment to not tolerating anything that isn't tolerant. From a sense in which all ideas would have equal weight in the public arena, to a sense in which no idea which would presume to be true is allowed in the public arena. That seems to be the kind of tolerance that people want now, or that some segments want now.
Yeah, well, that's, I think, very bad, very dangerous. It seems that the people on the left today are more intolerant than they know, but perhaps also the people on the right are more tolerant than they know, if it's really the case that they aren't really ethnic cleansers.
That's right.
And so somehow believe in toleration.
Which I think makes a lot of people on the right very frustrated.
Yes.
Because they are more tolerant than they know. They certainly think of themselves as tolerant.
Yeah.
It's not that they obviously know. I don't think anyone thinks of himself as intolerant.
But they think that together with tolerance goes the obligation to make judgments or to pass judgments.
Yeah. And that some judgments
are
wrong.
Judgmental.
Some judgments are wrong.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
If you're truly tolerant, then of course, you can't say Hitler did anything wrong, or that Stalin is to be condemned, or that anything, because you'd have to tolerate absolutely everything.
Yes, and it does seem that you can't tolerate people who are intolerant, like Hitler and Stalin.
That's true. Well, this brings up. I know you've had some discussions with Richard Rorty, who can't find. And calls himself a liberal and thinks he's a consistent liberal who can't find a reason to, other than that it's distasteful to himself and to a lot of people. Is that, obviously, there's...
Yeah, well, I don't go along with that.
I know that.
Seems quite wrong to me.
He
is, I think, a prime example of the degeneration, perversion of liberalism in our day from a belief in liberty, which has a solid ground, to a belief in emancipation, which has no ground at all except the assertion of the person claiming it.
Well, yeah.
Of course, that does. If that is your version of toleration, then everything really is a matter of force and fraud.
Yeah. See, but in practice, I mean, he's not in favor of Hitler and Stalin.
Of course not.
And he's a reasonable person one can argue with. And so I wonder whether these cultural wars aren't somehow still open to maybe not persuasion, but at least argument, civil argument.
Or as he would say, joshing or something like
yes.
that.
Storytelling?
Joshing, right, or storytelling. Yeah. But some stories are more interesting than others and truer, too.
And truer, yeah. yeah.
oh.
But in public, I mean, does the genius of the American founding really allow public claims of truth? Other than something like all men are born free or something like that.
Or an equal, yes. All men are created equal. I think that's our self-evident
that
truth.
Is our
it not only is allowed, it's required
yeah.
for our country to stick together, I think. That's still our principle, and we still believe it in practice.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Somehow in theory the belief has gone, and we need to be very careful and be very sure before we abandon it.
Yeah. Yeah, Mary Ann Glendon here at the Harvard Law School makes a point in her book Rights Talk that your point exactly, we're not nearly as atomized as our legal language would make us seem to be.
Yeah.
That I think she uses a phrase, when we sit around the supper table, we don't.
Kitchen table,
the kitchen
right.
table, we're not. Right. Yeah, we're not nearly as separated and.
Of course, one of the yeah. one of the great problems and something about which she is concerned is a long cycle of decline, as habits of thought and the institutions that support them continue to
yeah.
Decline. That sort of commonality that's required, even for the belief that all men are created equal, becomes more and more tenuous. And it's that's the most critical loss.
Well, but shouldn't that belief be renewed by the constant need to remind ourselves that this is our principle and we have to live by it? The civil rights movement, or the wars that we fight in defense of liberty, or our liberty, those things ought to remind us of our of the fundamental principles that we have and that we share. Because those principles, yes, do become routines and dead if occasions don't arise which remind us of their importance and centrality.
Yeah. But even if we do keep those principles in mind, certainly they're that in itself is too thin to have a moral. Virtuous society.
It's just a reminder that there are certain things which we do hold true.
Precisely, yeah.
And I think that's a necessary reminder towards a beginning attempt to recover our commonality.
Yeah. Do you think the founders had a worry not just that that this society wouldn't work if people weren't committed to some sort of at least attained, but still a religion or some sort of religiously founded morality? Was it so much that they were worried that it wouldn't work, or that they were worried that the principles that they were inculcating posed a challenge to those types of moral persuasions?
Oh, I'm sure that most of them believe that religion and freedom were compatible.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a great advantage of America as opposed to the French Revolution.
Right.
where those two things fought each other. And, so we must try to recover that sense of compatibility.
But it has to be a religion which has sort of a fundamental commitment to, not necessarily to the commitments that it gets from its history, but these new commitments of toleration and of individual rights and whatnot. And even if a particular religion can live peacefully in such a society, it seems to me to be very dangerous to ask it to adopt those moral principles as its own. I mean, again, you know, Locke wanted to exclude Catholics.
Yes.
I think for reasons other than he said explicitly. He said explicitly because they have an allegiance to a foreign prince. I think that the reasons are that, and I think he understood the reason is more profound than that, and it has to do less with allegiance to a foreign prince and more to allegiance to principles which are unyielding in their claims that there are true things and there are false things, and the false things ought not be permitted. And
of course, it's interesting because Tocqueville thought that Catholicism was, as he put it, the perfect democratic
religion.
Yeah,
I know, that's really, I've never quite understood that.
Well, maybe McIntyre shed some light on that when he talks about the Presbyterian presuppositions that he sees infusing Locke's work. Whereas Tocqueville, of course, has some notion of what Catholicism really is.
Yeah, so I suppose Locke wanted to wait until Catholicism made itself tolerable.
Right.
Which it has essentially done.
But not necessarily for the good of Catholicism, though. I mean,
yes, that's the real problem. Yeah. Somehow to make religion and freedom live together in such a way that religion remains religion.
Right. If a religion thinks that it's true, and if that truth undermines the polity be damned.
Well,
because that's whether that's good or bad, or whether there is such a true religion, the fact is people who believe their religion to be true think that way often, and to try to now I think you're right, it has been accomplished that the Catholic Church has forgotten that, but
doesn't toleration have something to do with the libido dominandi, the desire to dominate? No religion, including Orthodox Catholicism, or at least Orthodox Catholicism, does not claim to know all that there is to be known. But often, the sort of both friends of toleration on both sides and the intolerant all claim that here's the truth, and I will now describe its entirety to you, and if you don't go along with it, you're wrong.
At the same time, denying that there is a truth.
Yes.
Or that they are saying anything that's true. Well, with a point like that, maybe it's time to stop.
Well, it's certainly been a good conversation.
Yeah.
Thank you, Harvey.
I've enjoyed it very much.
Take up. I tried to get us off on abortion. Perhaps we'll do that the next time.
Yeah.